Some years ago, my wife and I were on vacation in Hawaii, and we were visiting with the hotel concierge to plan out some of the activities that we were going to do while we were there. If you've been on a vacation like this, you know there's dozens and dozens of things that you can do. And so we had picked out a few things that we were interested in, and as we totaled them all up, we realized that's more money than we had budgeted to spend on this kind of a thing. So we were kind of trying to decide in front of the concierge, well, maybe we do these ones and not that one, or maybe these ones and not that. And then she said, you know, I can get you a $200 US credit if you will attend a timeshare presentation on one of the afternoons that you're here. So we looked at each other and we thought, well, that would allow us to do all the things that we want to do. And we get to go visit this really nice place too, and we're not gonna sign up for anything, so sure, we'll do it. So she started doing the paperwork for us, and then as she was doing it, she looked at us and she said, I just need to confirm that a couple of things are true about you. Is your income more than, and I think the number was $85,000 US. Now at the time, I was a seminary student, and my wife was working part-time, I think at McDonald's, so safe to say that was not true of us. So I said, well, no. And she said, well, what about the second thing? Do you own your own home? At this point, we were renting a home on a farm and kind of working off the rent as a seminary student. So, no. She said, oh, well, they want these two things to be true of you because they don't want to waste their time with people who don't have enough money to actually buy into it. She didn't say that, but that's kind of what the implication was. But she said, you know what? Just say yes. It doesn't really matter. They're not going to check with you while you go. So I looked at Jenny and I was like, should we sign it? Should we say yes, even though it's not true? We said yes. The presentation wasn't for 3 or 4 days. And in the meantime, I kept thinking about this. Was that the right thing to do? Should we have said that or should we have not done that at all? So finally, I said to Jenny, I'm just not feeling comfortable with this. What should we do about this? We clearly lied for our own advantage on this thing. Nobody's going to get hurt. Nobody's going to know except that we know and God knows. And so we decided we're going to go to the timeshare presentation. We'll go a few minutes early and we'll just tell them at the beginning. We signed these boxes. They said it didn't really matter, but you should just know that if we don't qualify for the $200, that's fine. We'll just go. They said, they weren't actually really clear in what they said, but they welcomed us into the timeshare presentation. We took it all in, and at the end of the day, they didn't give us the $200, which maybe that would have been nice for them to let us skip out on it. But at the end of the day, I felt better about telling the truth than if we had gone through and told a lie for our own advantage. It's so easy to do that sort of a thing in that kind of scenario, or actually in many of the scenarios that we find in life. And Jesus, in the passage that we studied today in the Sermon on the Mount, urges us to be people who tell the truth. In fact, our big idea is simply this: kingdom people are truthful people. Kingdom people are truthful people. Now, in Matthew 5, which we've been studying for some weeks now, we have come past a point in Matthew 5, verse 20, where Jesus has said to us that unless our righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, we will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. That's a pretty serious challenge, given how respected and spiritually mature the Pharisees and teachers of the law were seen to be. And Jesus now is giving us 6 examples of what it means for us to have righteousness that surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. What might this look like if we put this into practice? 6 examples, it's not an exhaustive list, but it gives us an idea of what Jesus means when he said that sort of thing. And in this one, we get to instructions about telling the truth. Now, the first 3 that we've already studied were about murder/anger, adultery/lust, and divorce. And the final 2 are going to be about revenge and loving your neighbor, or loving your enemy, rather. So it might seem to us that this particular one about telling the truth might be the easiest of the 6 for us to put into practice. But keep in mind how the Bible talks about the tongue. James, the brother of Jesus, actually wrote a book that ends up in the New Testament, a letter that ends up in the New Testament. And he compares the tongue to the rudder of a great ship, or to a small spark that sets an entire forest ablaze. The way that we use our speech, the way that we the words that we use are so, so important to how we follow Jesus. And if we're going to be really honest with ourselves, we're probably not as squeaky clean as we wish that we were. So let's read Jesus' words. Matthew 5, verse 33. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot even make one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. So Jesus specifically here is talking about the swearing of oaths. Let's just define our terms here for a moment. We're not talking about swearing as in curse words. There's other verses we could use to talk about that probably. We're talking about the formal swearing of an oath, making a promise while invoking God's name. So our Mennonite Brethren Confession of Faith defines what swearing an oath looks like really well. So I'm going to quote from it. Swearing an oath involves a special verbal and or an embodied symbolic action that invokes a divine being, one's own life, or a sacred object, for example, God or the Bible or your ancestors, etc., to support or authenticate that a person is telling the truth. The implication is that swearing an oath reflected an invitation for the power being appealed to, maybe God or heaven, etc., to bring about devastating actions against the swearer if they lied. This would bring a special weightiness to the promise or the verbal proclamation, since the swearer would certainly not want to have these devastating actions visited upon them. So swearing an oath is what Jesus is specifically referring to here in this manner. So three sections here, the same three sections we've been working with the last few weeks. Number one, the Old Testament command. Second, Jesus' teaching. And then three, implications for our faithfulness. So number one, the Old Testament command. Now, as we've looked through the previous three examples that Jesus has given of, you have heard it said, but I tell you, Jesus has quoted from a specific chapter and verse from the Old Testament. In this section, he actually doesn't quote from a specific chapter or verse, but he refers back to general Old Testament teaching, where the swearing of oaths was actually a regular practice. It actually was an encouraged practice. God told the people that they could, and in fact, that they should do it. So let me give you two examples of this. There are lots of them, but let me give you two. Deuteronomy 10, verse 20. Fear the Lord your God and serve him. Hold fast to him and take your oaths in his name. In other words, use God's name in the swearing of oaths. You should do this. Numbers chapter 30, verse 1 and 2 says this. Moses said to the heads of the tribes of Israel, this is what the Lord commands. When a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to obligate himself by a pledge, he must not break his word, but must do everything that he said. And then chapter 30 of Numbers goes on to talk about vows in various contexts. So take an oath, go ahead and do it. Just make sure that you follow through on what it is that you're going to do. Now, Jesus calls this out, though, because what had happened in the intervening time, and certainly in Jesus' day by the Pharisees, was that an elaborate system had been built around the swearing of oaths that reeked of legalism. The Pharisees were missing God's heart completely and were making this into a legalistic pursuit. So here's how this kind of worked. Using God's name was feared. There is some rightness to this. In fact, they're motivated in part here, rightly so, by the third commandment, which says, do not use the Lord's name in vain. So there is a fear that if I make an oath and appeal to God as the authority behind my oath, and then I fail to fulfill that, then I have taken the Lord's name in vain. I've used it improperly. I have brought dishonor upon God. I've slandered his name somehow. I'm bringing a bad reputation upon God by doing so. So I'm not going to use God's name at all. So to get around this, they would actually swear oaths on things lesser than God. And there was an elaborate system whereby if you swore by something kind of close to God, you would be obligated to fulfill your vow. But if you swore on something far removed from God, then you don't really have to do the thing that you're promising. And Jewish teachers were called upon in various ways to decide whether a person had to fulfill their vow based on the thing or person that they swore upon. So Bobby makes an oath and he swears it in the name of his dog Spot. And Courtney makes an oath and she swears it in the name of her son Sam. Well, the Jewish teacher is going to look at that and say, well, a son, that is a very solemn thing to swear an oath by. Courtney is bound to do what she said that she would do. Bobby, bounding himself by the name of his dog, not quite as impressive. So we'll maybe give him a little bit more grace to do or not do the thing that he said that he would do. It's turned into a ridiculous system. In fact, there's a Jewish book of teaching called the Mishnah with a whole section on vows and oaths and when they're binding and when they're not. One example from there is that if you swear by Jerusalem, you are not bound by your oath. But if you swear toward Jerusalem, then yes, you are bound to do what you said. You can see why Jesus wants to pull his hair out. So Jesus, in his response, maybe even suggests a hierarchy here or gives a hint to the hierarchy. Scott McKnight suggests this, that Jesus says you shouldn't take an oath by heaven, very close to God, or by earth, maybe the next level down, or by Jerusalem, the next level down, or even by yourself or by your own head. You can see the kind of hierarchy that Jesus is reflecting in his response. So this is a frivolous system of when a person could be believed or not. It was actually an excuse to lie in certain instances. It's sort of the equivalent, you remember in elementary school where you're saying some kind of grand promise to someone with your hand behind your back, and then when the other person gets excited about what you're going to do, I have my fingers crossed, it doesn't count. Same sort of thing. I didn't swear by anything that was very serious, so I don't actually have to do the thing that I said I was going to do. So Jesus is frustrated by this. And actually in Matthew 23, Jesus pronounces seven woes, W-O-E-S, on the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, things that he is really upset about them for. And this is one of the things that he picks up on. So chapter 23, verse 16. Woe to you blind guides! You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gold of the temple is bound by that oath. You blind fools! Which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gift on the altar is bound by that oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, anyone who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it. And anyone who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And anyone who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Similar to what Jesus is saying in Matthew 5. Where he says, don't swear an oath by heaven, for it's God's throne, or the earth, for it's his footstool, or Jerusalem, because it's the city of the great king, not even by your own head, because you can't even control the color of your hair. In other words, all things belong to God. And you have very little control over many of the things that you are swearing things by. So let's just cut it out. Let's just stop with all of this ethical gymnastics that we're doing around truth-telling. Say what you mean and mean what you say. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. McKnight says that Jesus' language is designed to push into the deepest levels of verbal communications. One is to be invariably honest. And when everyone is invariably honest, we will have a kingdom world wherein oaths will not be needed. Jesus' followers ought to be defined by honesty. Kingdom people are truthful people. Now, James, brother of Jesus, who I've referenced already, this letter that he wrote, I've suggested to you before that I think that James is actually writing a commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. He's reflecting many of the same themes that Jesus is teaching on. And he repeats Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5, verse 12. Above all, my brothers and sisters, don't swear. Not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no. Otherwise, you will be condemned. You notice there's some teeth to this command. James says, otherwise you will be condemned. Jesus says that anything beyond a yes or no comes from the evil one. So let's think about the implications for our faithfulness, starting with those teeth at the end of this command, okay? We need to recognize the battle that we're in, and sometimes that battle is framed in terms of the unholy trinity of the world, the devil, and the self. And so when you look at those three things, you can see how untruthfulness, lies, unfaithfulness, they're so subtle and sinister in all of those ways. Think about the world. We live in a deceptive world. Right? We actually see this more and more today. When you go online, if you go on social media and you see a video these days, it is becoming harder and harder to tell, is that actually true? Did that actually happen? Or is that an AI creation? It's harder and harder for us to tell what is true and what is false. And people lie all the time. In fact, we just expect people to lie all the time. We expect our politicians aren't going to tell us the truth. We expect that when we see an advertisement that it's probably too good to be true, and that if we read the fine print, there's going to be something in there that actually makes it sound a lot less great than it seemed like it was to begin with. We live in a world of ambiguity and half-truths and exaggerations. Think about Satan. Satan is described by Jesus as the father of lies. Everything untrue flows from him. It's also said of Satan that his native language is lies. He doesn't speak English or Spanish or French. He speaks lies. This is what comes most naturally to him. We see this actually right at the beginning. Adam and Eve are in the garden, and Satan shows up and he tells them a half-truth, something that has a little bit of truth in it, but isn't actually true when you actually look a little bit deeper. Did God really say? This is a tool of the enemy. So why would we want to align ourselves with his main tactic? And then we think about ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I mean our false selves, the sinful nature that we combat every day, that we do battle with. And that false self is far more deceptive than we want to think that it is. Studies suggest that people lie 1 to 2 times every day. That means that you tell hundreds and hundreds of lies every single year. Sometimes it might not be an outright lie. Sometimes it's an exaggeration. Sometimes it's a promise that you don't intend to keep. Sometimes it's just trying to say something in a certain light that makes you look good. And then we lie to ourselves all the time as well, don't we? About our value, about our worth, about how other people must be thinking about us, about how I don't really measure up, about how my best isn't going to be good enough, and about God and how he must not really love me because he knows the things that I've done and the kinds of things that I think. We lie to ourselves, and we actually, when we live off of the identity of lies, we get ourselves into a lot of trouble. So I want to think about what it means to be truth tellers in a very specific way, and then in a more general way, okay? In a very specific way is about the swearing of oaths, which is the language that Jesus uses here. And Anabaptists and Mennonites and Mennonite Brethren, the faith traditions that we belong within, have understood Jesus' words very literally here. We should never swear an oath in any kind of official way. And many Anabaptists and Mennonite Brethren, and even actually if you go back to the early church, people who understood Jesus literally in this way too, many people have suffered because of this. It's not as common today, but in our ancestors' history, there were times when it was a common thing for there to be maybe a yearly affirmation where you would have to swear an oath to follow, maybe it was the Roman emperor, maybe it was the mayor of the city or the leader of this region of the world that you were living in. And Mennonite Brethren Anabaptists have typically refused to do so, and some have suffered the greatest of costs because they've refused to swear that kind of an oath. This language is found in our Mennonite Brethren Confession of Faith in Article 12, which is about society and state, which is interesting. There's a connection between those two things. But let me read for you part of our confession in this regard. The primary allegiance of all Christians is to Christ's kingdom, not to the state or the society. Because Christ forbids the swearing of oaths, we simply affirm the truth in legal transactions. Believers do not participate in secret societies which demand the swearing of oaths, or which otherwise conflict with the Christian's allegiance to Christ and the church. At all times, believers are called to live as faithful witnesses in the world, rejecting pressures which threaten to compromise Christian integrity. Now, if you take this belief and apply it to the extreme, and there are religious groups that have done this, including some Mennonite groups and Quakers, for instance, they would reject things like mortgages or signing up for military service, which would require swearing an oath to your country, or similarly serving in government in any kind of capacity. And if you take it to these kinds of extremes and more, the natural response then is that the religious community needs to form its own kind of community, separate from the world. And Mennonites at times have done this, because in these kinds of societies, you can arrange it in such a way where you don't have to swear any kind of oath. Taken a little bit less extremely, this would mean not swearing an oath in court. In fact, this is the most obvious and famous application of Jesus' teaching in Mennonite Brethren Anabaptist theology. You will not swear an oath in court. So do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God? Mennonite Brethren would say, I'm not going to actually do that. I'm not going to put my hand on the Bible and actually make that kind of an oath. Instead, I will tell the truth, and I'll promise to tell the truth. I will affirm that I will tell the truth. But swearing an oath and invoking God's name is not something that I'm comfortable in doing. Tim Gettert's a Mennonite Brethren theologian, and he tells a story of one time when he was summoned to jury duty. And he went to the selection day where the judge is going to choose the people that he wanted to serve on the jury. And at one point he asked all of the potential jurors a question. He said, "Do you swear that you will do everything that I as the judge ask you to do in the course of this trial?" And Tim tells the story of how they went down the row and people were saying, yes, 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 yes. And it got to him and he said, no. And everybody looked at him and the judge stopped and said, what do you mean no? And Tim's answer was, with all due respect, judge, I can't actually imagine a scenario in which you would ask me to do something that I would not be comfortable in doing. But I cannot hear sit here and tell you that I will do everything, because my ultimate allegiance is to Christ. And if you ask me to do something that conflicts with my allegiance to Christ, I won't be able to do that for you, so I need to answer no to your question. If I remember right, he was not asked to serve on the jury. This is a good example. Now, you might say this seems like semantics. What do you mean you won't put your hand on the Bible and use the word swear, but you will say that I affirm to tell the truth? Might seem like semantics. Mennonite Brethren throughout the years have not found it to be semantics. They've taken it very, very seriously. I will say this though, if you look at the whole of Christian theology, this interpretation, the Anabaptist perspective on this, is a minority position. I studied 8 commentaries in preparation for this sermon, and only one of them suggested that this might be an appropriate way to follow Jesus' commands here. And then there is sort of a spectrum. Some of these commentaries didn't mention it at all. Some commentaries made a note to say, Anabaptists and Mennonites and Quakers and maybe a couple other groups have taken this to mean that you should not swear an oath in court or in military service, etc., etc., and this may be a legitimate way to follow Jesus' commands. And then there was a commentary that said, Anabaptists have taken this to mean that you should never swear any kind of oath, and they are being legalistic in the way that Jesus actually doesn't want us to be. So there's that perspective as well. It's a minority position, but one that is in our confession of faith and that we've taken seriously. And you should know, by the way, that in the Canadian legal system, there is the option for you to simply promise to tell the truth rather than swear an oath. So if you ever find yourself in that scenario, you can ask for that option and they will give it to you. There are questions around this perspective, and including questions like, it seems like Paul seems to use kind of an oath formula in Corinthians and in Galatians. And what about Jesus? He was kind of put under oath before Pilate. And actually the two sides read that exact same instance in different ways, how Jesus responded to it. But something for us to think about and be aware of for sure. So that's the really specific example, but let's make it a little bit more general and talk about truth-telling in general. Our Confession of Faith makes this statement: disciples of Jesus should consistently use truthful speech and be faithful to their promises. This is another way of saying our big idea, that kingdom people are truthful people. So how does this kind of oath speak work its way into our general language, or does it? Well, it does, because you probably hear and maybe even use a phrase like, I swear to God. I swear to God, the fish was 4 feet long. I swear to God, I'll get it done by Monday. Or I swear to God, I'll pay it back. Or I swear by all that is holy. Or people all the time will invoke God's name to damn something. Or they will use the name of Jesus Christ as a swear word. Why do we bring God into these sorts of things? Isn't it interesting that people who claim no belief in God at all will still use the authority of God's name in these sorts of ways? That tells you maybe something about our consciousness of God, even if we won't proclaim belief in it. Why do we do this? Well, Dallas Willard suggests that there's a real reason why we do it, and it's not a good reason. Maybe he says that we do these sorts of things to impress others with their sincerity and reliability and thus gain acceptance of what they're saying and what they want. It is a method for getting their own way. It's simply a device of manipulation designed to override the judgment and will of the ones that they're focusing upon, to push them aside rather than respecting them and leaving their decision and action strictly up to them. So rather than just saying what I want to you, I'm going to invoke some sort of higher power and attach it to my words to try to make you believe me and do the thing that I want you to do. Willard says this turns into some sort of song and dance. And honestly, we don't really like it when people do this. We don't really like it. There was a guy who showed up at my doorstep shortly after I moved into my home, one of the guys from one of the telecommunication companies selling alarm systems, security cameras and all that kind of thing. And I didn't have that, so it was interesting to hear his pitch. And he was friendly. He was a little bit pushy. He said things to me like, my boss says I have to sign up 5 houses in this neighborhood. I've got 3. Someone else down the street is interested, and you could be number 5. And if you're number 5, I'm going to give you the best deal that I possibly can. And it was pretty interesting, but I said to him, my wife's not home, I should talk to her, so give me your info, send me the offer, and I'll talk to her about it. So I did talk to her about it, and we decided, you know what, it's not a bad deal, maybe, but we're going to say no. So I emailed or texted him and said no. He texted me back at 10 p.m. He said, can I call you? I should have said no, but I said, yes, you can call me. He said to me, I just need one more person in your neighborhood, and I'm going to make this worth your while, and I'm going to help you through everything, and I'm even going to put $200 of my own bonus towards your contract. That's how seriously I want you to have this. At the end of the day, I signed a contract, and I vowed to myself after that I never would with that kind of pressure tactic. Now, in hindsight, it's been a service that we've used, and the price hasn't been too bad, and so, you know, it's all okay, except that I never heard from that guy ever again after that conversation. And that interaction left a really bad taste in my mouth about him and about the company that he represents to a degree as well. We don't like it when people use this kind of manipulative language to try and get their own way. And yet, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we probably do it more than we want to admit. Sometimes we use this language to get our own way. Another way that we might embellish the truth or exaggerate or reason why we do that is for validation. I want people to be impressed with me. I want them to validate me. I want to get good feedback from people. Sometimes we do this in the way that we tell stories. Listen to someone tell a story about their latest vacation, right? Sometimes I wonder, was it really as good as you're telling me that it was? And I hope it was, but I know the tendency for me to be is to make it sound a little bit better, maybe to justify the expense of where we went, or to justify the time away that it took for us to go, or just that people will be really impressed that I had such a great time. I want people to validate me. George MacDonald said this, "My respect for the world's opinion is my greatest stumbling block, I fear." That's relatable, isn't it? We want people to be impressed with us, so I'm going to add a little bit to this story. I'm going to exaggerate it a little bit. I'm going to promise something maybe that sounds really good, but I'm not sure I'm actually going to do. Sometimes we do this to avoid shame. I'm not going to tell the whole truth because I don't want to be embarrassed by who I actually am or the things that I've done. And there are contexts where it's maybe not appropriate to share all of those things, but there are contexts where we actually ought to be sharing all those things to let people know who we are. So here's the application. I want to give us some homework this week. I want you to do a speech audit this week, to pay attention to what you say. And I'm going to give you a few areas that you might want to pay attention to, though go beyond this for sure. Number one is when you're telling stories. Is this story actually accurate? Or am I adding a little bit to the length of that fish? Or to the scope of the accomplishment that I was able to do. Is this actually accurate, this story that I'm telling? Number two is in your workplaces or in your school. It has never been easier in the age of AI to attach your name to something that you didn't write or that you didn't do. And I know this is a big problem in schools, and there are lots of tools that have been developed to try and work against students using AI in the course of their work. But if we're going to be followers of Jesus, shouldn't we be honest in presenting our work as our own, if it is our own? And if it's not our own, to give credit where it's due? Shouldn't that just be natural to us as Christ followers who are truthful in what we say? In your workplace, are you honest in your reporting about things? Are you honest in even how you record how many hours you worked or what you actually accomplished? What about making promises? Sure, I'll do that. Yes, I will do that. I will fulfill what you want me to do there. I'll come help you move, or I'll fulfill this contract or whatever. Are you being truthful in what you say in those things? Now, there are instances in life where you say that you're going to do something and then you end up in the hospital or there's some sort of emergency and you can't follow through. Jesus would understand those sorts of things. But Jesus here is telling us, let your yes be yes and your no be no. So some of you actually need to learn how to say no. I would love to help you out with that, but I just can't do it for whatever reason. Maybe you share the reason and maybe you don't. Maybe it's just, sorry, I can't help you with that. But if you're going to say yes, then you need to do everything you can to follow through on that promise. And then lastly, when talking about your future, James 5, if we had time, we could go there and read, but James urges people to be cautious in planning out their future because God is sovereign and you are not. So when you make plans about the future, are you boasting about all the great things that you're going to accomplish and do, or are you saying things like, if the Lord wills, if he enables me to, then this is what I'm thinking I'm going to do in the future. But God can redirect me at any time because I belong to him and my ultimate allegiance is to him. So do an audit. Maybe it's at the end of every day, or maybe even as you're having conversations, you think to yourself, how truthful am I being in my speech right now? But maybe you want to make some observations at the end of the day. When was it easy to tell the truth? When was it hard to tell the truth? Was there a certain person that I found it difficult to tell the truth to? Was there a certain topic that I found the need to embellish something about? Was there a certain scenario in which I found myself really wanting to add a little bit to a story or to say something that wasn't true? Did I make any promises today? And do I intend to fulfill those promises? Take an audit of your speech and see how well you're following Jesus' words here. Kingdom people are truthful people. So let's be that as citizens of the kingdom. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have given us so much, including your son Jesus. And we know that Jesus himself is the truth. And so we strive to honor and reflect Jesus. in every part of our lives, including in our speech. We know, Lord, that it is easy to be dishonest, to embellish, to tell half-truths. So, Lord, help us to be people who are truthful in what we say, who say yes when we mean yes and no when we mean no. And in doing so, may we honor you and may others see you in us. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.